As part of this program, we're able to take questions from physicians as well about HIV/AIDS, and they're interested in learning more about antiretroviral therapy.
Does everyone infected with HIV need treatment?
That's actually an easy question, and it's no. But then you have to dissect the things we've been talking about. It depends upon patient readiness for lifelong medication. It depends upon their stage of illness, their CD4 count. Risk and benefits of these medications always have to be considered.
Most people will eventually need therapy. There's are rare individuals called long-term non-progressors that have an immune system that seems to be capable of containing the virus, but those are people are few and far between.
So what are the current medications in the antiretroviral armamentarium?
Well, I think before we go into specific drugs or specific drug classes, I think it's really important for clinicians to understand the life cycle of the virus and what the targets are for these drugs, so that the whole way we combine them makes some sense. So when HIV attaches to the outside of a CD4 cell, a T helper cell, it has to hook onto two different proteins, the CD4 receptor, and now we know that it has to hook onto a second protein called the chemokine co-receptor. Then the viral membrane has to fuse with the cell membrane for the contents of the virus to enter the cell. After the virus enters the cell, all the component parts come apart, and the viral genetic material is there in the form of single-stranded RNA. And the virus only has three enzymes, three proteins that are key to certain chemical interactions. And the first step is a viral protein called reverse transcriptase, which takes the virus from its single-stranded RNA and makes it into double-stranded DNA. And once that is complete, the double-stranded DNA migrates into the nucleus of the cell through a hole in the nuclear cell membrane. And there, by means of the second viral enzyme called integrase, that piece of viral DNA is inserted into our DNA. And you can think of this as kind of a hostile takeover. Once the viral DNA is in the command center, the brain of the cell, then instead of the cells, the original activities which that cell was prepared to do, it essentially just becomes a little factory for more HIV. And the viral DNA then directs the production of viral-specific proteins and the other components of the virus itself. And those proteins and components are made out in the cytoplasm of the cell, and then they aggregate together to become a new virus. And key in that process just before aggregation is where the third viral enzyme called protease comes in, because when these viral proteins are made, they come off the ribosomal mechanism as one big molecule. And that molecule is inactive. And the viral protease cuts that big protein into its component parts, making the functional enzymes for new viruses. And then, as I said, they aggregate, move to the surface of the cell, and then bud off from the cell membrane. So the first class of drugs we had, reverse transcriptase inhibitors that were of the nucleoside chemical family, and they were aimed at that target. And the second family of drugs we had were called non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors. That's because we as scientists are so creative. And that also targeted that same enzyme, but a different physical spot on that enzyme. And the first drugs that we had that inhibited protease really marked the beginning of the new era in treatment, which we refer to as the HAART era, and that's an acronym, H-A-A-R-T, that stands for Highly Active Antiretroviral Therapy.
And when we talk about the six classes of drugs, we now not only have the reverse transcriptase inhibitors and the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors and the protease inhibitors. The fourth is a fusion inhibitor, T20, which has been available but difficult because it is an injection. It's twice a day. There's a lot of painful injection site problems. So it's not gotten a lot of use, and it's certainly not used up front. It's used more in our salvage therapy. All of our guidelines have always said we use two of the nucleosides, the older drugs, as our backbone, and then we add either a non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitor, that's the three in that particular type of protocol, or we add a protease. And in this day and age, we always boost the protease inhibitor. So that's the four classes we've always had. We have two new classes of drugs that really aren't specified in the protocol. They're not really indicated at this point for the naive patient, the first drug regimen. They're used in salvage in people who've developed resistance who are out of options. So now we have six options, and the last two are an integrase inhibitor and a CCR5 or a chemokine receptor inhibitor.
We can come up with a medication regimen for almost anyone who's HIV positive to very specifically treat their virus. The amount of scientific information that has been translated from a basic laboratory situation to actually treatment has been fantastic, that we can really offer people very specific and very effective therapy for long periods of time. And the good news also is that these new regimens are becoming more and more tolerable so that we can truly think about having people take these medications for years, not just weeks or months as we did before.
Well, let's delve into the specifics a little bit more. Which treatment regimens do the guidelines recommend?
The current recommendations are as follows, that there is a preferred approach to the treatment of people who haven't been given antiretrovirals before, and then there's a set of alternatives. You turn to the alternatives when somebody has the inability to tolerate one of the preferred drugs or has acquired a virus from the outset that's resistant to one of the preferred drugs. How these guidelines will evolve is hard to determine right now, because all of a sudden now we have these additional classes of drugs, some of which may be ultimately very promising for the initial treatment of individuals with HIV.
And there's the guidelines, as she said, are very specific for pregnant women. And pregnancy has been a huge issue in this since the very beginning. In the old days, before we knew what we know now and before we actively tested women on an opt-out basis and treated them if they chose, the overall statistic was that 25% of babies born to a woman who had HIV would also be HIV infected. Because of using aggressive triple drug therapy for the benefit of the baby, we now have that incidence down to less than 1%.
We should mention that all of these guidelines are readily available on the web, either at cdc.gov or at hivinfo.gov. So they're very easy to obtain.
I have to say, we truly are fortunate again to have you HIV specialists here to discuss this issue with us. One of the things that I think a lot of primary care physicians would be interested in is which laboratory tests would you recommend clinicians run before initiating antiretroviral therapy?
You know, I think there's a kind of a panel of laboratory tests that most clinicians tend to run, and that is the routine ones, such as a CBC, a complete blood cell count, a chemistry panel, mm-hmm. just looking for kind of general sort of abnormalities that can occur. Anemia, low white blood cell counts, thrombocytopenia are very common in early HIV infection and need to be identified early on. Liver function tests need to be monitored very carefully as well, liver enzymes specifically, to be able to see what kind of medication regimen might be best for that person if they do need to be treated early on. And then, of course, other things such as pancreatic enzymes, lipid panels, because we are, of course, also interested in whether or not the person may have pre-existing heart disease that needs to be taken into account as part of their next regimen for HIV infection. We also screen for other infectious diseases that might be co-transmitted with HIV, syphilis, hepatitis A, B, and C, and also other kind of routine tests I shouldn't leave out, such as a viral load for actually quantifying the amount of virus in the person's blood, and also look at their immune system. The other thing we oftentimes are recommending now, as the guidelines are, is on that first visit with the patient, is to get an HIV resistance test. Whether the test is going to be used immediately or simply put into the patient's chart and used for later isn't really so that much important. But what we've discovered is that HIV resistance tends to fade over time. We know that people can become infected with an HIV-resistant virus the very first time they're infected. And for that reason, it's good to document that resistance, because resistance in HIV is something that never goes away. It becomes embedded in the patient's virus for the life of the virus and life of the patient, so that getting the information early on, even if the patient's not going to be treated immediately, is a very important way to start HIV therapy at the same time.
Assessing scattered cities across the United States have shown that over the last 4 or 5 years, transmission of resistant virus happens in about 13% of all new transmissions. And that's important because you don't want to choose the wrong drugs from the outset.